Beim Yeshiva try very much to connect with you, to share with you our own lives, our own experiences, where we are, where you are. And I think to a very large extent, Baruch Hashem, we're successful at sharing our experiences with you. I think, you know, when those who, like myself, who had the experience of knowing people who are older, who are part of a different generation, not knowing of them, but knowing them, it's where it's a little bit different. So I think when you hear about people who you didn't personally experience, you're hearing about things as opposed to understanding and feeling a person. You know, sadly, Rav Lichtenstein is someone who, outside of his, you know, narrow family, over the past many years, people have not had the chance to really experience him or experiencing him for who he was for many years. I think that's a sad thing for people your age, older than you, to not be able to appreciate what there is to appreciate. I'd like to try and do my best tonight to help bridge that gap for you. You know, when the world, when the Jewish people lose someone, our goal should be not just in a meaningless way to cry over what's lost, but more importantly to think about what we need to repair, what we need to compensate for. That's really what Kaddish is about. We say Kaddish because there's less Kiddush Hashem in the world and we want to compensate for that. And it's not just a quantitative thing, you know, 89 points on the Kiddush Hashem scale. It's also the kind of things that were present and not present. You know, when you know someone, when you knew someone personally, for sure someone, a very special, great person, as sick as they may have been, when they're gone and you know you won't see them again, and, you know, I davened every morning with Rav Lichtenstein Shacharis, including Sunday morning. This morning was the first morning he missed. When you realize you won't see someone again, it's a very powerful emotion, especially when the person means so much to you, and you kind of assume you're going to keep seeing them and be reminded of all the things that person represents for you. So there's a big rush of emotions and thoughts and feelings, and you know, we delayed speaking about it till tonight because we felt it's inappropriate on Rosh Chodesh, but it also gave me a chance to just try and collect some thoughts, and that's why I generally don't write things up, but to write things up because I really wanted to make sure to do my best to try and share with you and give you a sense of the very special person, and I use, you know, that word intentionally, person, you know, who was lost to the Jewish people today. The Gemara in Moed Katan Daf Chaf Dalet tells us that when they told Shmuel, the great Bar Plukta of Rav, about the death of Rav, Amru le Shmuel noch nafshe de Rav. It says Kara le Tracer money. He tore 12 pieces of clothing. He was wearing them all at the same time, whatever it was. Amar Ozel Gavra to have a mistafina mine. He said the person who I was afraid of have left. Now, you think he should be partying, right? So again, what Shmuel meant is what Shmuel meant, and there's a debate amongst the Mefarshim. But I think Rav Lichtenstein, not just for me, was a person who people feared. Not in the conventional sense of the word. Not in the sense of you were afraid he was going to do something to you. But more in the awe sense of the word. In the Yiras HaRomimus sense of the word. There are, I would say, kind of, you know, not going to say lahavdil, even though it's a little bit different, the way people are afraid of Rav Nevinsel. I don't think anyone is afraid that Rav Nevinsel will turn them into a frog. Right? When I was in yeshiva, there was this weird guy, you know, who people said, you know, who knew incantations, just stay away from him, don't cross, we'll turn you into a frog. I don't think Rav Nevinsel has turned anyone into a frog. I don't think people are afraid to turn into a frog. You don't want to get in the way of someone who you know is great and involved in important things and understands life on a different level. there was a real awe that people had and have for Rav Lichtenstein, and I want to explain why. Very famous Gemara in Brachos, Yochanan ben Zakkai, we'll talk a little bit more about later, was on his deathbed. Talmidim came in to see him, and he said, Rebbe, you know, give us advice, give us Brachos. And Yochanan ben Zakkai said, your fear of heaven should be like your fear of your Rebbe. And of course they said, that's it. And he said, halavai. Now, you know, maybe it's a good thing here that people aren't afraid of their Rebbe. It's a good thing to have a real relationship. But there are some people you're just afraid of. You just have a fear and awe of. And I think he's the kind of person people really felt it with and still feel it with. You know the way you guys, you have to go ask a question to, I say have to go ask a question to Rav Nevinsahl. I always remember first week as my guy comes over, asks a question, so that's a great question to ask Rav Nevinsahl. No, like, what would I do? What would I do? Just go over and ask him. So you walk over, you're nervous and everything, etc. You know it from him, that's the way it was with Rav Lichtenstein as well. When you walked over to speak to him, there was a trepidation. Not because he wasn't sweet. Rav Nevinsahl was also very sweet, right? I don't know who I talked to, right? Rav Nevinsahl couldn't hurt a fly. Couldn't. There was a fear because you were walking into another zone. You know, a trepidation. Whatever you said would be carefully thought out. You didn't want to waste his time, say the wrong thing. I still remember a story when I was your age. There was a Shabbaton, different guys, so he gave questions and answers. His question and answers were very different than the way I do. Each question was very, he would give a long answer. It was like two or three for an hour and a half. That would be, you know. So a guy asked a question. He says, can a person have a different Rebbe for Halacha and Hashkafa? That's a question, right? You know, you understand that question, right? So he says, surely you don't mean that. What would you do? I think I do. Ask your question again. What would you do? So he said, can a person have you know, a different rabbi for a long time? You mean can you or may you? By now the guy was totally, you know, was way past his, you know, now you understand what he meant, right? The guy said, I don't know, can you, may you? So he says, can you, may you? Two very different questions. He launched into his whole discussion of whether a person could have a different Rebbe for Halacha and Hashkafa. What could be Bezdin do to stop you? Would they do something to stop you? It was really important. Now he's buried. Then he said, Mayu, that's a very, you know, interesting question. And then he thought anything about the Mayu. I don't think he meant it in a derogatory way. I think he took him serious. So on the one hand, there was and is, and I think will always be, for those who knew who Rav Lichtenstein was, a tremendous amount of awe, a word of what we call Yira. But interestingly, Rav Aaron was also a person that people loved, had very warm feelings for. And I want to try and help people understand how this duality was possible, where it came from. He's a person who really inspired people. There aren't a lot of people who inspire people. I want to explain a little bit what I mean by this. He made you believe in what people could be, in what you could be. He gave you reason to believe in the things that we believe, and believe in how they could be lived, both in general and by yourself. And I don't just mean by what he said. I mean by what he embodied. And this is a very important thing about people in general. Seeing who he was made people want to be better people. They made people want to hold themselves up to a higher standard. They made people expect more from themselves. We all know the Mishnah in Avos. We read the Pesach Shabbat, the two Shabbatot ago. Hamidu talmidim harbe. The term hamidu doesn't just mean to teach. It means to stand people up. How do you cause talmidim to stand up and not just teach them Torah? Well, it's by inspiring them. It's giving them a model to identify with. It's giving them something to model themselves after. On a personal level, you know, I'll share with you, you know, throughout I'll share, you know, I don't want to speak just personally because that'll be just personally. I want you to understand the broader ideas, but I want to share with you the personal things that connect to these ideas. You know, when I first met him, I was a person who took Torah seriously. It was the right thing to do, an important thing to do. But I would say he was the first who caused me to see Torah as more than just something I was responsible to do, but something I could love, something I could make my life's passion. You know, he was a model of what a mechanech and a leader is meant to be, and he was the first to cause me, and many people like me, to seriously consider going into chinuch. Because just to see a great person, you know, a lot of you guys, you have doubts, you have questions philosophically, you have issues, you have wonder. You're exposed sometimes to people who, they may not give you answers, but seeing a person like that living their lives the way they live their lives can help you have more than what answers could possibly give you. To see someone who's intelligent and thought out, living his life seriously, committed to these things, is more than any answer to any question. So basically, I want to elaborate on what generated this yira and this ahava. I think people, the world as a whole, are most familiar with him because of what made him most unique. Therefore, most famous, most relevant. There are people who never met him, never will meet him, don't know who he was in his temple, but they know what he believes in Torah Mat. Right? Or, you know, fill in the blank. In that way, he was an icon. And I heard the word used today a number of times. I have a problem with the word. I'll explain later why. But he was an icon. In the sense that he was not only someone whose greatness in Torah and as a person gave credibility to what he believed in, but more than that, he became a symbol of those beliefs. Very often more than anyone else, because of who he was and the sharpness with which he believed in these things. And I think probably the most famous aspect is the interface of Torah and Judaism with the secular world, with secular culture. And I'll begin with this, even though, and as I'll soon explain, I think it's unfortunate that this is what he's known for. Because it misses the big picture of who he was and why his belief in this was so important and, you know, was so powerful. But first, to talk about this, he wasn't just someone who believed, you know, that one could or even should study, you know, a secular culture. But he's someone who believed in integrating between the two. And he's someone who showed how it should be done, not just in practice, but as a person. A very good example of how he applies his, you know, his background in literature to his learning of Tanakh. His analysis of characters in Tanakh, which today a lot of people take for granted, but he was one of the first to do it from that perspective. You know, when he would give shir, he would quote in all kinds of contexts philosophy and literature. Not as like a cute little thing to add on. It fit into what he was talking about. It was part of his Mishnah. In a real, natural, integrated way. Not as a way of saying, hey, I study literature. He really lived both together in a cohesive way. I read online today, you know, one of the students was writing about how he came from America's background. Those who know what that means. And it's that first time in Rav Lichtenstein's Hashkofashir, and he's talking about a machlokas and Pirkei Avos, Rav Shimon, Rav Yehuda, and he goes, this machlokas is reminiscent of the machlokas between the Catholics and the Protestants. It was an amazing thing for me to hear. But more important than the intellectual level is that he lived it. It's what he really was. And not on some level, but on the highest of levels. And what I mean by that is, on the one hand, he truly understood the best of the secular world. On the other hand, he was a real, genuine Talmud Chacham. Not a guy who learned a little bit in high school, or in yeshiva, or daf yomi. To be one of the Gedolei Hador in Torah, and to have this integration, is a powerful thing. If I'll just elaborate a little bit on the uniqueness of it, let's say the Rambam, medieval philosophers, you know, filtering down to people like Rav Soloveitchik, focused on how science and philosophy related to Torah. A big part of Rav Lichtenstein's Chiddush, which is why he used the term Torah v'chochma as opposed to Torah umado, is about how we should be interfacing with art, with literature. There's a story I heard him tell when he first got to YU. He asked Rav Soloveitchik, what should I learn? What should I study? So Rav Soloveitchik, remember, he goes, study math. So he went and took math. So after he took a semester of math, he came back to Rav Soloveitchik because I took math. I didn't enjoy it very much. What should I do now? He said, take more math. So he went and took more math. He took more math. He still didn't enjoy it. He came back to Rav Soloveitchik, what should I do? Take more math. He goes, I stopped asking him. So the idea of being able to apply it in new ways. I think today, by the way, the idea of integrating with secular culture, because of secular culture's emphasis has changed. It may not be, you know, high culture. It's just the way people live today. And he already had the seeds of it. I remember I went to his house once for Shalosh Shudas, and he was talking about learning from everything. He was talking about learning from sports figures. So his children, who weren't shy to challenge him, they go, what do you mean learning from sports figures? They're all interested in the money. So he said, well, you see someone like Michael Jordan? High temperature, and he's able to, you know, as a famous in the 90s, you know, play and score and win the game and championship. And his son said to him, he's doing that for money. He goes, it could be he's doing it for money, but the ability and the commitment is something to learn from, to see the positive in everything, to be able to learn from everything and everyone. I want to add to this that I think what made it legitimate, what made it real, what made it ideal was that he was a person dealing with the modern, the contemporary world in his time, but also a true carryover of the generations before. And that balance is essential. It's easy to be a traditionalist who locks himself in the bubble of the past. And it's easy to be a modern person who reflects the values in the world around them. To be both, and to balance both, is a very different ballgame. The idea of being a true continuation of the classic Lithuanian model of yeshiva, of Torah, of commitment to Torah, in the real sense of the word. And there are stories people will tell about this which are important. I'm not going to get into it because I think it's less central to what we're talking about. But he was a traditionalist. The difference, by the way, in how he's viewed in America and Chutzlaretz and how he's viewed here. Chutzlaretz is viewed very much as a renegade, or relatively speaking. In Israel, he's viewed as a traditionalist. It's all relative to the cultures. To be a continuation of the past in a real way, but to be translating it to the present, that's the balance and the challenge we have to strike if we want to be genuine continuations of the Mesorah. And I think, you know, before I talk about the other things which I think made him unique, this made him unique, but this wasn't who he was, it's what he believed. It's what he embodied, but not who he was. But just to talk about this for one more second, I think it accounts for his open-mindedness, for his nuanced view of the world, just having been exposed and appreciating and validating and believing in the things he was seeing in the world around him. You know, and I'm exposed, and I know, you know, many people who stand for Torah, stand for Mother, stand for both. But I don't think there's anyone alive who can be mentioned in this regard in the same breath as him. And in this way, it's a loss. Big loss. Not because the philosophy becomes illegitimate, but because you don't have a person who lives it that way. And when it's living being, when it's real, it's different than anything on paper. One of our alumni wrote today to me, so there's no one left. Something along those lines. I said, Baruch Hashem, every generation has felt that way. It's all relative. And as we'll talk about it, the question is what we do now with the world we're left in. But as I you know, implied before, I think the focus on this issue, his modern beliefs, whatever you want to call it, have overshadowed a number of other significant aspects of who he was. Many of which, in my opinion, are even more significant than this issue, at least they were for me. And, you know, I think his association with a particular yeshiva, with a particular hashkafa, you know, kept him from being appreciated by people who identified with others in the past, and I fear in the future too. Because most of what made him special are universal values that shouldn't depend on your hashkafa. I think those who really knew him, even if they disagreed with him, understood the greatness of the person of who he was. The problem is that people didn't know him as personally, very often didn't. And this is really what I want to talk about. And I want to talk about three main things. I want to talk about his Torah. I want to talk about his ideology and commitment. And I want to talk about his character. Because in each one of these areas, I think we're dealing with a very special person who we have to take away from. And I'll elaborate on each and talk about them. Let's begin with his Torah. His knowledge was really, very much, you talk about Rav Avadya and his way, what he knew. I also think it was similar in what he knew. Not just objectively what he knew, but his assumption that's what a person needed to know. It's connected to his humility, but also what he expected from us. That's what you need to know. To see someone who knew this much in an unassuming way was very threatening. Because what did it imply about you? His scope, his holistic view. He knew all of Shas B'Iyun off the top of his head. Before learning the Masechta again, he could tell you the Shir already. He was a model of what we aspire to. And the assumption that one really could, not just know Torah, but know it in depth. All the parts of the Masechta. Not just the Prakim that were learnt. Torah Shebaal Peh in the broader sense of the word. He was one of the first to integrate the learning of Medrash Halacha and of other Svarim that weren't classically learned, but even like the Rav Yoh and the Ur Zeruah and all kinds of other Rishonim on the Masechta, to learn Torah in depth in a broad way. Of course, beyond Gemara and Torah Shebaal Peh, his emphasis on Tanakh and Machshav at a time when it wasn't done. I think he's also famous for his methodology of learning. I think this methodology is the reason why so many others learned how to learn B'Iyun from him. Many of the people teaching B'Iyun today, here, other places, are people who picked up an understanding of methodology from him, something he developed at a time when the term and the concept of methodology in the learning of Gemara were seen as a stira. I remember my grandfather learned in the yeshivas in Europe. When he heard that I was learning from Lichtenstein, he was very upset. He said to me, Lichtenstein is not a Rav, he's a scientist. My grandfather was right about the rest of the second part of the statement. The notion that Torah could be learned and, more importantly, taught with techniques, which is important if you want to teach it to other people. Developing the method of how the brisker derech, which sounds like a narrow thing, but the understanding of a sugya should be learned. How to ask conceptual questions. How to understand the ways to find the answers, to identify the answers and the implications within a sugya. How to categorize ideas. But beyond that, maybe even a much bigger chiddush, is the importance of how something is presented, how ideas are organized, how the flow of ideas is presented, which is something you would take into account in any other area of study. What about in Torah? I remember the first time I gave a chabura for him. He said, I agree with everything that was said, I totally disagree with the presentation. Again, you're talking about someone, coming from a traditional background, like, what? Again, these are terms you hear, but a big part of why you hear them is because he was the person who introduced them. Shouldn't it be? Shouldn't Torah be studied in a categorical, careful, thought-out, organized, flowing way? And I'm moving from the, it's hard to say least important, but from the less important to what I see as the most important. I want to talk about his ideals and his commitment. There's definitely no one I've ever met who is a greater Yirei Shamayim or Eved Hashem. I don't want to say I've never met people who are equally, because clearly I know people, but no one greater. He had a real relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. Now there are many Gedolim this way, but to see someone who is so connected to the general world, which often leads people to be more relativistic, who was this way. Someone who was able to take the best of the civilization he lived in without allowing it to take him from the classical values of commitment to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I remember, I was a little older than you, someone asked him what he thought about watching television. It's a funny question, like today, none of you watch television, right? What do you mean? So he said in his own innocent, the way he used to speak, he goes, you know, many questions here. You know, talk about the balance of time and culture. I assume, of course, you're talking about the good things on television, like Masterpiece Theater, which some of us had heard of. He was a big machmir. He wasn't flexible or lackadaisical about halachic observance, like you find people today who were involved, many people in the modern world. I remember once I asked him an important medical health question that he wouldn't answer because he was machmir, which has to do with his sensitivity too. He told me who to go to. I don't think anyone who ever saw him daven on Yom Kippur will forget what it looked like. Or Shoshana Yom Kippur. You could daven four times because you forgot Yalav Yovo and he would still be standing there. You know, we'd be ending Musaf on Yom Kippur, he'd still be standing there. Standing up straight, 2 feet together, davening. There was a sense that you, and I'm not exaggerating, you'll hear rational people talking about there was a sense that you were in the presence of a malach. And anyone who davened with him on Yom Kippur remembers what his face looked like after Ne'ilah. It was a light. I want to speak about his commitment, his work ethic, his hasmada. I don't remember in 15 years a single day that he missed being in the Beis Medrash when he was in the country. I don't remember a shiur being cancelled. There were days that it was clear that he wasn't feeling well. It didn't matter. He was in the Beis Medrash. I'm sure that he had more responsibilities than I have, but he would sit in the Beis Medrash for hours moving. I mean, for hours not moving. He would sit and learn without being distracted. When you had a question, you know, I've never told you, you'd have to walk and stand there and wait. And it could take a while till he noticed that you were standing there. I remember he would come straight from the airport to give shiur. He would give shiur the morning of Yom HaTzmaut when everyone was going off because it's a holiday in Israel. Like, no, there was shiur. Two stories that I heard from students. I wasn't in the yeshiva at that time. One was during the first Lebanon War in the 80s, early 80s. He came personally at 4 o'clock in the morning to wake Talmidim up because after davening he was asked to fly to Lebanon to meet with the soldiers with the Talmidim, so he didn't want to cancel shiur. What kind of message did that give to Talmidim about shiur? So when my sons had their bris milah, I made sure not to schedule it during shiur because I had to be in shiur. Not because he asked me, expected it would say anything to me. Because it was a model of the seriousness with which things were taken. In the Gulf War, one night guy spent the whole night in the Cheder Atum, in the sealed rooms. The alarm's going off. Well, they didn't sleep the whole night. 7:30, finally the alarms were called off. Guys came out, daven Shachris. What was everyone going to do right after Shachris? Sleep. Well, this is announced. We're having Shir 8:30. It wasn't as a message. It wasn't as a shtuch. It was real. It wasn't an act. It was real. This is what we have to do. This is what we're going to do. I remember in 1990, the 49ers beat the Bengals in the last 19 seconds of the Super Bowl. A Super Bowl in America ends, what time, about 12 o'clock, I don't know exactly, right? So Shear began right after. So he came into Shear and he said, I just heard on the radio, in 19 seconds, Bengals beat the 49ers. This is Israelis in the Shear, right? Because you see from me a very important lesson. You don't waste 19 seconds. And he wasn't joking. He wasn't saying it as an acute part. So some of the old timers told me that when the Colts beat the Cowboys on a 12 seconds field goal in 1971, he said the same thing about you. 1970, whatever it was. He would walk with a sense of mission. There was no one who could keep up with him, and I'm talking about when he was 65 years old carrying a full load of sperm. He had places to go and things to do. I want to speak about his willpower and self-control. I don't remember exactly when, going back 7-8 years ago when he was sick, being sick began, he had a very bad fall. big injury. Most people, after an injury like that, they just end stay in a wheelchair. He willed himself back to functionality, and I saw it personally every day. In shul, in the street. Like I said, I saw him at Shachris yesterday. Today was the first day I can remember him missing. This self-control, this focus. I remember that every day of shir would end during lunch. And lunch was the same thing as it is here. If you came 10 minutes late, so then you got what was left after 10 minutes, right? And so you're sitting there in shir, you were shpilkis. Now, it wasn't because he had to finish something. If he finished a topic at 1 o'clock, which is when lunch began, he'd start a new topic. Which is always very frustrating. There was a message that we're doing something important that we need to control, focus on priorities. Every move, every action was carefully calculated. His principles. If Horn told me a story today that I heard from Rav Schechter, I was surprised about the first part of the story, that when he applied for Harvard graduate school, the Rav told him he should take off his kippah so he'll be accepted. And he didn't do it. Not just because of his principles, but he was comfortable and confident with who he was, and if someone else wasn't, not in a haughty way, but in a very principled way. His ethics. One could speak just for an hour about his ethics. His yashrut. Very often there are things that halachically may be permissible, but he held himself up to a higher level of ethics. It's a famous article about whether there's an ethic beyond halacha. Now, Feldman told me a story today. You know, when you travel for any institution, you get paid a certain amount of money a day to use for food, for lodgings, for whatever. So he came back, and he had been put up by friends, by students, and he wanted to return the money. So the director said, no, the money is for you, that's what's given, you didn't use it, so you keep it. He goes, no. He said, no, you should keep it. So he came back for Yom Kippur, he insisted that he take it back, I can't go into Yom Kippur having this money. It's totally mutter, and the director wanted him to have it. His vision and sense of responsibility. He took himself seriously. He saw what he was doing as very important. He took his life and life in general seriously. He had a sikha that he would give every few years in Tanis Esther, where he would try to impart this to kids raised in a world to care about the pursuit of their own selfish things and not any higher values. He would talk about Esther being challenged by Mordechai to understand what her mission in life was. He would ask us to think about what our mission in life was and whether we were in a direction to fulfill it. I read a story someone told today that he wrote. He was once in shul and he saw a kid with a t-shirt that said, basketball is life, the rest are details. He said he wanted to go over to him and speak to him after shul. Would he wear that to a job interview? Would he wear that in front of the king? Because the kid ran out of shul. Because what I was thinking to myself, how many of us could substitute for the word basketball, career, pleasures, and believe in essence the same thing? His passion. Unfortunately, he's known as being an intellectual, not just intelligent, and he definitely was an intellectual. But if intellectual means being without passions and emotions, then that's not who he was. Thanks. Anyone who spent Simchas Torah with him, there was a tremendous amount of Ahavas HaTorah in the real sense of the word Ahava. There's a very famous story in Boston after Tisha B'Av. They all went to eat, and they couldn't find Rav Lichtenstein. Rav Salvage, he said, Rav Lichtenstein, want to wait? So he was learning. They called him over, what are you doing? He goes, I want to tiny, you're not allowed to eat, you're not allowed to learn. What did you miss more? It was not a vort. It wasn't a... He had an Ahavas HaTorah. But I want to speak more than his Torah and his commitment about his character. And the reason why is because I think that especially those who didn't know him, those who didn't experience him, are naturally going to remember him for his ideology, for his beliefs, for his commitment, without realizing the model of a man that was lost. I mentioned before, people spoke about him as being an icon. He was an icon. He is an icon. But he was also an unbelievable person. Rav Blachman once told me, you know, we say in the morning, "La'olam yehi adam yirei shamayim v'seif shavagoli." Because people don't appreciate that before you talk about being yirei shamayim, you have to be an adam. He goes, Rav Lichtenstein is an adam. I think he was a tremendous yirei shamayim too, but he was also an adam. He was, and I think people who knew him realized it, and it's not an exaggeration to say he was an angel of a man. You know, the day when he's going to be buried, the 17th day of Sefira, is Tiferes Shebe Tiferes. Tiferes is different than the word Yofi, because what it means is synthesized beauty, where a lot of different things come together. There was something very beautiful about the package that was him. Not just the things that he synthesized, but the person who he was. First of all, his sensitivity and care for everyone. He cared and showed a tremendous amount of respect to everyone. For example, he would stop at the side of the road to offer tremps to Arab women carrying things on their heads. You know those when you see those things? It sounds fanciful. He showed a tremendous amount of respect to Talmidim. When he gave you a tremp, first he would go and open the door for you, and then he would go around and, you know, and get in the car. It was embarrassing, right? He would often come around the Beis Medrash, say, "I'm planning to give Shir Klal in this topic. What do you think? Is it good for you? Would you like it?" When he was mastered by Shlomo Zalman Orbach, he said about him that even if he wasn't religious, he would have been the nicest person in Yerushalayim. Says in Mishlei, "Ish ish mahalalo." You learn from what a person celebrates who they are, and the same thing could be said about Rav Lichtenstein. I remember, and this is something which will transition to his great humility. At an elderly age, probably was he was definitely over 70, definitely over 70. I'm driving from the gas station near my house back to my house, and I see that he's walking to the corner to get a tremp. Now tell me, you think the yeshiva would be willing to have a car, a taxi for him, etc.? He's walking to the corner by Tzomet Gush Etzion to get a trip. So I circle around. When I come back, I'm driving. Oh, Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim, yeah, sure. He starts being suspicious. Are you going to Yerushalayim anyway? Where are you going into Yerushalayim? Chas Hashem, someone should help him. Someone should do something for him. I lied. He never sought or accepted kavod in any way, shape, or form. He refused to be given anything, to have anyone do anything for him. When a couple would offer him a tramp, so the husband would say, "Please come sit in the front," he refused. Wife is sit in the front. Sit in the front. When the yeshiva first began, in Kfar Etzion, there was a dining room and a Beis Medrash. They didn't have enough chairs. So every day, a third of the guys would have to take chairs from the Beis Medrash to the Chadar Ochel. So what would happen? A guy would look around, see how many guys were carrying chairs. Hopefully he wouldn't have to carry a chair, right? Every day, Rav Lichtenstein carried a chair. I heard this from people who were there the first years. Not as a vort. Not to show, okay, carry chairs. When he would go to a wedding, Simchas Chasam Kali wouldn't dance the first dance and go home. He would stay till the very end and keep dancing. Like I said, he would never let anyone do anything for him. It was never about him. Not only that, but the opposite. There was nothing that was below him. There's a famous story. Some guy showed up at the yeshiva, because he didn't have a beard, and they asked him, "Which way do you go to this dormitory?" So he goes, "Come, I'll take you." Pick up their suitcase and started walking with them. Till, you know, some of the guys saw, what are you doing? They took the suitcases from him. And again, not as a vart. Never willing to take help. When I came to interview for the yeshiva, I learned in the shir, and then after the shir, you know, I was supposed to talk to him. He used to always walk around with a big stack of books. Not like the Makoros, yeah, you know, he would bring every sefer to the shir. So he had a big stack of books. He had a wooden shas, wood box with a shas in it. So he picks up this big stack. He said, "Can I help you?" No. He starts walking with this huge thing of books, and I'm walking with nothing. So then we get near his office. He has to get his keys out. He's holding this big stack of books. I saw a second. I went, no. He leans up against the wall with the books. Starts wedging his hand into the pocket to get the keys out. How hard would it have been? Not to ask me to take the books. I said, can I do it? Okay, yeah, here, let me get my key out so we can go. Even when he wasn't well, he wouldn't let anyone help him. It was never about him. He never asked me or anyone for anything. And the amazing thing is that it wasn't an act. He really was this way and didn't realize he was. He was just a very special person. And I think this is probably why people respected and loved him so much. He was a real example of the concept of someone who is boreach min hakavod, kavod boreach acharav. I think it's an important thing for us to learn for our lives, which are in a society that's too often about that. His gentility. I don't ever remember him getting angry. And for sure, I don't remember him acting mean or vindictive. Even when he disagreed, sometimes vehemently, he showed respect and sensitivity. I remember when Shivat HaKotel split, and I went to ask him advice about what I should do with myself. He advised me to stay. And he told me, you're going to have a lot of mud thrown at you. But remember never to do it, because when you throw mud, it remains on your hands. He was low-keyed. Except when it came to something that he believed. And because he was low-keyed, when he spoke firmly, you knew it was significant. The power with which he shared Torah, and particularly the values of Torah. Talmud told a story. Once he took a trip into Yerushalayim, so he started asking them, so why did you make Aliyah? So he said, because I feel you'd be in the state of Israel. So he said, well, why did Rav Soloveitchik not make Aliyah? So Rav Soloveitchik is contributing to America. He goes, so why didn't you stay? Back and forth. Got out of the car. One of the Talmidim said to me, that was very insensitive. How could you, ask him those kind of questions, personal questions, Rav Soloveitchik, back and contrasting them off each other? Because he went the next day to apologize. Rav Soloveitchik got angry at him. I don't know what you're apologizing for. Don't ever not ask questions. He was a person who was low-key, so when he spoke with passion, you understood it was important. I still remember, and it's a story I remember every time people complain. I was in yeshiva. You had hot water sometimes. You didn't have hot water sometimes. You complained. They fixed it. They didn't fix it. You know what I'm saying? You guys know, right? So a guy wrote on the fix-it chart, they don't fix his hot water, he's going back to the army. So remember, he told the story. He goes, I have one thing to tell that person. Shilich! He started screaming. He should go as quickly as possible. If he doesn't understand what he's doing here and why it's a priority and things here, people here to serve him. When he spoke with passion, you understood it. You realized it was important to know what was important, what's not important. To be soft and to know when to be strong. And I think the greatness of Rav Lichtenstein was to be such a great person, such an exceptional person, but to be so humble and so gentle at the same time. You don't find that. The Gemara in Sukkah, Daf Chav Ches, talks about Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. We mentioned him before. He knew Mishnah, Medrash, Gemara, Halacha, everything there was to know. And the Gemara in Brachas Daf Yudzayin also says Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, no one ever said hello to him before he said hello to them, even a random goy b'shuk. That was Rav Lichtenstein. He had every reason to be above everybody else. Every reason. But he wasn't. And I think you talk about all the things we're speaking about. You might find someone who has one or some of these things. But the package of all these things in one person, things that generally are mutually exclusive of one another, this is what made him so awe-inspiring, respected, and loved at the same time. And admired even by people who villainized him. I want to conclude with what all this should mean to us. And I think this is the most important part. Because it's easy to tell stories about people and summarize their lives. and put it in a book somewhere. And there's going to be a lot of that. There's going to be a lot of that in the next days, weeks, months, and years. And I think it's unfortunate. Because every time you spoke with him about anything, about himself, he always turned it back to you. It was always, what does this mean to you? I don't want to be too specific, but he spoke often about how boys left yeshiva the right way, the wrong way. People who could be better. People who could be making more of a difference to the Jewish community. People who could be devoting their lives properly. And as much as he toiled to set a model up of modernity and commitment coming together, and I wasn't here when he arrived, but I'm sure he's contributed to Eretz Yisrael being stronger in this regard. As we know, there's still a ways to go. And I think in two main ways. On the one hand, an openness, but on the other hand, a genuine, absolute commitment to the highest levels of Kiyum Mitzvos, the pursuit of Ratzon Hashem, the Liban HaTorah. And that's what he stood for. So many people talk about the broader values without understanding the core that needed to go along with that. It's like reading the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim but not knowing his Mishnah Torah. And so many people identify with A without understanding that A is meaningless without B. And he would talk about this. And I think the second issue that's become a bigger issue, specifically in the second part of his life, but becoming more and more, is how to interface with the changing world by being a real continuation of the Mesorah. He was a traditionalist. Which is why a lot of, you know, the modern world was frustrated with him. Because he wouldn't move quickly enough, fast enough in the direction they wanted him to go. I remember I once had an opportunity to go to America and be involved in something. And it was to be involved with some of the more modern aspects of the American, you want to call it Orthodox community, and all that. And he cautioned me. He told me to stay away. He was very clear on what the lines were. And he was a Talmud Chacham whose lines meant something. So many people who aren't a hundredth of the Talmud Chacham he is, or the person he is, feel that they can go 100 times further than he felt was legitimate or not. And just because he felt the line is a certain place doesn't mean it's, you know, Torah Misinai. But make sure you're that person, that level of a person, before you feel that you can have the audacity to disagree. There's a real question, I think, still out there about whether his vision is realistic. And of course, we determine that. The most important thing about other people, living or dead, and for sure when they're dead, is what we take away from their lives for ourselves. The Rambam begins Sefer Mada with Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, the core of what it means to believe as a Jew. And the two things he talks about are God and Torah, because those are the two things, right? You got to believe in God, you got to believe in the Torah. Fine. In the first part where he talks about God, he talks about belief in God, and he talks about commitment to representing God properly. Kiddush Hashem, Chilul Hashem. And of course, Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem are generally thought about in reference to mitzvos and averos. The Rambam ends off Perakei by talking about how Kiddush and Chilul Hashem also relate to how you act as a person. When a person who represents, is associated with Torah and Avodas Hashem, does things that are inappropriate, it's a Chilul Hashem. And the Rambam talks about how terrible that is. And then he says, if a Chacham is careful with himself, and he speaks softly with people, and he gets along with them, he's insulted and doesn't return it, he honors them, even those who don't honor him, he deals with people in a faithful way, he's not involved in the stupidity of Ami Aretz. Translation, playoffs, I don't know. Ela osek b'torah otuf b'tzitzis muchta b'tfilin. He's seen all the time osek b'torah tfilin tzitzis v'osu b'chol mas of lefnim mishor sadim. He goes beyond the letter of the law. Achi matzo akol mekalsin aso v'ovin aso. Until people are all praising him and loving him umis avim lemasav, and yearn and desire to be like him. Hareza kiddush Hashem. The alav hakasav omer vayomer li avdi ato Yisrael shebecha esbar. This is the pasuk that says about the Jewish people, "You are my eved, that I take pride in." I believe that there is no better description of who Rav Lichtenstein was and what he represented. And there's no better picture to put next to this than his. And that's what made him special. Not the fact that he believed in Torah Amada. And not the fact that he developed a methodology of learning. Those are both very important things. And only make who he was so much greater. And unfortunately, I believe, it's those things people talk about and feel. He was an angel of a person. As far as his commitments, he lived on that level. In his Avodas Hashem, in how he related to other people. I can't speak, I don't know every Jew everywhere. I never met anyone like him. And for sure to be involved in the real world that can bring you down and impact you so negatively, and to maintain that standard. To be involved in having to run a yeshiva in the real world, not just sit in the corner, and maintain that level of character and ethics. It's hard to understand how it's possible. I think that people just were both impressed and awed by it, and realize they're dealing with someone who's just different. I never met anyone like it. I doubt I will. So it's the point to glorify and say he was very special. No, the point is for us to ask ourselves, how do we want to be ourselves? What do we want to devote our lives to? What do we want our character to be? What do we want our work ethic to be? There were a lot of people who were exposed to who he was and took aspects of that with them to take themselves seriously. Because you saw him take himself seriously. So those who go tomorrow, I assume you'll hear a lot more that you can read online. Why should you go? You can just read online. In fact, I heard that Spathing will be online. They'll be online. So you could sit right here in this room on your computer, you know, having Cheetos or whatever, and listen online. Because number one, you want to show respect to not only a God of Israel, but an angel of a person. And number two, you want to devote yourself to thinking and reflecting about these values. I understand that as organized as it's going to be tomorrow, it's going to be a mad scene. It could be a lot of people. I don't know if we'll be together, we won't be together, etc. Mutter to take a sefer to learn, you know, listening to Espedim, etc., you know, in between, etc. The most important thing, whether you're there or not, is not to make the mistake of being an Ovid of a Lazar, of glorifying somebody else. We're not Christians. The question is what we take away and what we learn. Rav Tuvia told me today that over the last 15 years or so, he grew very close with Rav Lichtenstein from working together in the Yeshivot Hesder movement. Took tramps together. So we sat in the back. He said when Rav Tuvia said when his son was killed, as I don't know, Rav Lichtenstein's wife came to be Menachem. And some of the boys were talking about how Rav Tuvia's son was a big tzaddik, he was. And it wasn't even a challenge for him. He just sat and learned. He woke up in the morning, he didn't want to do anything else. So it wasn't like a avoida. Rav Lichtenstein said, Chas v'shalom to say such a thing. It's apikorsis. Just because a person acts like it's easy and automatic doesn't mean it is. Everybody struggles. And for me to hear that story is unbelievable, because Rav Lichtenstein didn't seem to struggle. And the reason I tell you the story is to realize that he had the same challenges as a human being like everybody else. He wasn't an angel. He was an angel of a man. We decide how we struggle. We decide what we accomplish. That's what we have to take away. To listen to how a human being was able to work on himself, to learn this way, to be committed this way, to act this way, to feel this way, to be this way, and to not allow ourselves any less than striving for that for ourselves. Not to be him. A big mistake I think a lot of people make when they deal with Gedolim is they try and emulate that person to be like them. No! He was a human being with strengths and weaknesses. And one of the mistakes people make in these kind of situations is that's the model we should all try and be it. There are a lot of people who tried to be it, failed, and missed that, failed to be themselves too. Each one of you has things that are better than he had going for him. But there are many other things that you have to develop that you don't appreciate as much. Make sure to emphasize and develop your own things, but learn the things that you should develop from who he was. Make sure to listen to what you hear and read what you read and ask, how does that relate to Reuven Tarragon? What is all this supposed to mean for me today and tomorrow? The very famous story about Rav Dessler, who was once on Har Menuchos, and he saw a young Koilel guy crying over one of the kfarim of one of the Gedolim. He came over, he was looking at the guy very intensively. The boy said, Rebbe, what are you looking at? What's wrong? He said, what are you crying about? He said, I'm crying for the Gadol buried in there. Rav Dessler said, I'm crying for the Gadol buried in there. There is no person who I was exposed to in my life who made me to expect from myself the amount that being exposed to him made me expect from myself. And that's the goal. To realize that a human being like you, like me, to know and live and act and be that kind of person. And to settle for nothing less from ourselves. Nothing less than the version of ourselves that meets that same standard. Not the version of ourselves that can be him. It's not about being him. It's about taking ourselves seriously. Not giving ourselves any hanachot, as we say in Israel. And realizing the importance of developing the core of Torah and Avodas Hashem while developing the personality of how we relate to other people and how we see ourselves, that an Eved Hashem and an Adam should be. That's the big picture. And I want to say, it saddens me that so many people we learn from Gedolim, but we take the parts that are convenient for us to take. There are people who learn from Lichtenstein to be Torah Mada, there are people who learn from Lichtenstein how to have brisker derech, there are people who learn from to learn the whole thing, even the things that are not convenient for us. That are not easy. That are not natural. How to be exposed to the broader world and be a genuine, fully committed, sincere Yirei Shamayim in Ben Torah. To maintain the proper priorities and values. To believe in godless Adam, but to be so humble, gentle, caring, sensitive. I know. Many tell me. Or I've looked and seen other. we don't live up to it. This is the age where you set that bar for yourselves. The greater someone is, the greater bar you can set for yourselves, the greater role model you can set for yourself. To be exposed to great people, whether Wolfenstein or others. It's not a competition. Superman, Mickey Mouse, Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Nevinsal, who's a bigger tzaddik? Who's a bigger... It's not, they're all tremendous. Gavriel, Michael, I understand, right? You think Gavriel, Michael sit down, you know, they're fans, I collect Gavriel cards, I collect Michael cards. You know. On the one hand, being exposed to such great people, on whatever level you're exposed, can help you raise your bar. On the other hand, the danger is you can latch onto one piece and think that's enough. And I saw it. People who took one piece without the full picture. Very often the piece that was least important. The psoilus. The piece that might have been easiest for them to identify with. For me, being exposed to someone like Lichtenstein meant that I had the ability to see how a human being could be a malach. Not that he didn't eat. Not that he didn't sleep. He used to fall asleep in his makom. Sometimes during shir, like he'd be giving chabur, he'd fall asleep. Not because he had slept 8 hours the night before. He was a human being! To see how a human being can be a malach. While living in this world, while exposed to this world, while part of this world, not because he's cut off and not exposed to the culture of the world that surrounds us. Rav Horn likes to tell a story. Once came to the airport, looks as he went on his flight, sitting in coach. He insisted always sitting in coach. These things, if you take from yourself, what it means to be about things that are bigger than yourself, about the values, about what you're committed to. It's not about you, it's not about you, it's not about you. It's about the bigger picture, it's about what you're accomplishing, what you're doing. The significance of all this, tonight, of people being taken, of hespedim, of going, not going, whatever it is what you take away. If you're going to go and not take away, you're wasting your time. Better to sit and think a lot about who he was and read and listen than to go. I feel yoytze zayin and hack around social scene. Hey, dude, hey, yeshiva, that yeshiva, and hack around. It's not where you go. You go to focus on yourself. I remember when I was in 11th grade, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky and Rabbi Moshe Feinstein died. Two of the greatest gedolim of America. I remember I was in 11th grade because I remember who my Rebbe was, Rabbi Meir Chorsky. And I remember we went to the Levaya. One of them, I don't remember being with him, but the other, I was standing right next to him and you couldn't move, so I was standing next to him the whole time. And just watching him at the Levaya was more than enough for me. I wasn't crying, wasn't just seeing him focused and thinking, and you could see he was internalizing, he was listening, he was thinking about himself. How he can learn how to be a better person. If we come out of this, the terrible loss to the world, to the Jewish people, to the Jewish people of Eretz Yisrael, to the Torah world of Eretz Yisrael. There are different types of Rosh Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael. Rav Lichtenstein was a Rosh Yeshiva of Limud. There are other Rosh Yeshiva who are leaders who are out there or this. He was Rosh Yeshiva of a Yeshiva. This big loss for the yeshiva world, for the Eretz Yisrael Torah world, for the general Torah world. We come out of this that we become people who can fill those shoes a little bit more than we've accomplished and channeled what we need to channel the way it needs to be channeled. And if not, then we really have lost too much. I hope this helped you understand a person who, it's not about words, it's about understanding. Really a mountain of man. A person who was in a league of his own. Vayal Davdin.